Welcome to the Global Marketing Show, the podcast for all things international business. I'm your host, Wendy Pease, president of Rapport International and a translation expert. Come along with me today as we talk to an expert in the global marketing world about facing their biggest fears, hearing about mistakes they made or saw, discussing best practices, and sharing fun travel language and culture stories. We have a very special guest. His name is Armand Adande, and he has years of experience in global marketing, so I'm really interested in digging into more about this. He's a board member of the French American Chamber of Commerce, and he's spent years as managing director at Socomex, which is a company that offers low voltage electrical networks, and they have offices all over the world. He has had a very celebrated sales and marketing career in all parts of the world, in Southeast Asia, the U.S., Pacific Rim. He's got an MBA in business engineering from the Institut National des Sciences Appliquées de Toulouse, otherwise known as the National Institute of Applied Sciences. He has a BS in thermoenergetic systems from the Institut National des Sciences Appliquées, which is in Normandy. And so you can certainly find him on LinkedIn, but I'd like to welcome you, Armand.
Thank you, Wendy. It's my pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have you here. So you're originally from France.
Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And so what was your first exposure to a different language or culture?
Well, obviously, when I was in school, we had to pick up some languages, right? I started with English. School, when in middle school, you can pick up your first language. So I was exposed to English in middle school, and then I learned Spanish. And I started working overseas in Southeast Asia, as you mentioned earlier, and in the Pacific countries for my first job. So it was
Okay, so wait a minute. So here you are in France, you're learning English in school. At yes. What age did you start?
You start at 10 years old.
10 years old? And do you have it, is it immersion or every day, or how is it taught? Because your English is very good, and I'm wondering if that happens with
you. You're kind. You're too kind. You start with a few hours a week. I would say, if I remember well, it's probably between 2 to 4 hours a week, I guess, if I remember well, you know. And obviously, you do that for a few years. So through all middle school, you can add a second language. And in high school, you have to maintain the language that you decided to pick. And I was fortunate when I reached my School of Engineering, I had some crazy teachers in English. It was also compulsory because the school was really, I think they knew that English was going to be very important for engineers. And so we had teachers that were very, very into getting their students to learn English. And I would tell you that it was tough actually, because they were thinking that English was as important as math and physics, and it was a hell to work with them. We had from 1 week to the other, I remember, pages of vocabulary to learn. We were learning different type of expression, but I mean, it was really, at the end of the day, it was really a good reward, because when I started working, I had some pretty good basics. And obviously, the only way to really improve your comprehension and the way you speak a language is to be able to go in a different country, right, where you have no other choice, and to express yourself in English or Spanish or whatever you decided to take on as a different language. And I was fortunate to go to Asia, so I met with a lot of customers whose language was not also, English was not their first language. And we started to communicate, and it was quite a challenge, quite interesting. You
know? Right, right. Because then you've got the multiple cultures going in with second language for, I just learned that in the United States, only 25% of the people are bilingual. Whereas the in the world, if you look at that number, it's 50% of the people are bilingual.
Yeah, which so is not US, surprising, right?
No.
When you think about it, obviously Europe, size-wise, it's very easy from, in 2-3 hours, you can be in a different country when you're traveling, right?
Right.
So I guess it kind of explains itself because you had no other choice to learn different language, it being German or Spanish, you know, or obviously English.
Right. So how many, do you speak French and English and do you speak anything else?
I speak Spanish also a bit. I tend to, unfortunately, I don't practice it as much as I wanted to. So when I was with Socomec, I used to go to Mexico because it was part of the territory we managed. So I was pretty happy to keep practicing. I can understand it pretty well. Sadly, I don't speak it as well as I can understand it.
Okay, so here you are, you speak French and English, and you take a job. And how old are you at this point?
It was just after college. So I did 18 months of civil service. So I was probably 24.
Yeah. 24. Okay, so here you are, 24. You don't speak the language of Southeast Asia, and you're sent to that part of the world to do business.
Yeah.
What was your biggest fear about doing business in other languages or another country?
I think the main challenge is really to make sure you understand the cues, right? You try to really make sure that customers can understand what you're talking about. And you can see, so you have to be very, to observe how people are reacting to what you're saying. If you start to see them doing faces, like, okay, frowning their eyebrows, you're like, okay, maybe I should rephrase this. So you have to be aware of what's going on. Obviously, you read the room and make sure that you also ask them to rephrase what you say. You know, from time to time, you say, okay, this is what I try to explain. What do you understand of what we just talk about? You know, just to try to see if they can put with their own words what you try to explain, especially when you're doing training, you know. You try to educate people on technical products. You want to make sure that they have a good feel of what the message you're trying to pass. So it's great to always be aware of what's going on. Try to ask people, you know, a few questions here and there to see how they comprehend, and also to understand how people are working. Obviously, you can talk, but you also need to have some materials that are written. So they can also read the things at their own pace, you know, and so also there's a way to try to make sure that they have the right comprehension.
Can you hold your microphone up a little bit? It's not
sure.
Coming in.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that will really help.
Okay.
Yeah, oh, that's much better. Okay. Okay, so it was all the language, communication, social clues, making sure you're really connecting with the people. That was your biggest fear, and it sounded like your biggest challenge too.
Yeah. It's to make sure, and after that, it's really the cultural difference. So, because doing business in Southeast Asia, it's a challenge. You may think that people understand the same, are working kind of the same way, but obviously you have differences between Indonesia, between Vietnam, between Cambodia, the Philippines. So each time you need to understand what people prefer, maybe what, you know, what are their habits. So it's kind of a lot of reading also, and you know, talking to other people who have the experience, who've done business for longer than you in those countries to understand what are their tips. So you try to really gather all this information to be as efficient possible.
Okay. So when you went over there, were you in global marketing or what kind of role did you take there?
I was an area sales manager at that time. So I was in charge of developing sales, and it was a B2B business. So I had to call on OEMs and also put in place distributors in Singapore, Indonesia, and the rest of this territory.
Okay. And so when did you first get into global marketing?
So I did most of the marketing when I joined my last company, because when I joined Socomec, the idea was to open a subsidiary here in North America. And we started from scratch, and I was in charge at that time of sales and marketing. And I was based in Chicago.
I'm having a little bit of trouble with the sound right now. I can't tell.
Can you hear me better?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Let's hope that. Okay. So it was when you came to Sonotec.
Socomec.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you were opening a presence in the U.S.
That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I was a number two employee. That's why I got transferred from France to the U.S. And the goal was for my responsibility was sales and marketing at the time. So I had a white page. And I was in charge of starting to really develop the sales and help build up the subsidiary here in North America.
Okay, so first we have to go. Here you are coming in first time into the United States?
It was my second time indeed, because during my previous job, the first job when I was in charge of Southeast Asia and Pacific countries, I was fortunate enough to have been transferred in the US for 2 years. The CEO of the company at that time thought that I joined the company just after merging of a French and an American company. And the CEO, from the American side, believed that I was in the top talent in the company. And so they believed that if I were able to sell in Chicago, I would be able to sell anywhere in the world. It was a very competitive market. So they sent me over in Chicago for 2 years to learn about how to work with distributors, how to set up manufacturing reps. So once I was done with this project, I ended up trying to implement this in Southeast Asia. And it was actually quite true. I managed to grow the sales in Southeast Asia and
Chicago.
And Chicago, yeah.
Okay, so we're going to get back to what you do on the business side, but now is your time to really laugh at Americans, because everything we do, we're used to the culture. What are the things that you found shocking or surprising about coming to the U.S. and meeting or working with Americans?
Shocking or surprising, let's say.
Or just different, or, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, there is a... There is something that is called, I don't know if you may be familiar with it. Do you know the communication style of peaches and coconuts?
Peaches and coconuts?
Yeah.
No.
So, well, it says that the American are like peaches. So they are said to be soft on the outside and friendly to people they just met. You know, usually people are smiling at strangers. I remember when I sit at the airport, you have people that will share their life to you, even share pictures to complete strangers. But when you get past this friendship, you see a very private person. And basically, it's very hard to get into that circle, right? That inner circle.
Oh, like the peach pit inside, soft exactly. on the outside and hard exactly. on the inside. Uh-huh. Exactly.
Whereas the French, they're like a coconut. So they're hard on the outside. They're not smiling to strangers usually. They don't engage in conversation like that. And they rarely talk about personal information with strangers, because they keep basically everything to close friends and family. So that's kind of a thing. But if you can break...
That's fantastic. Yeah, peaches and coconuts. I love it.
But if you can break the shell, you know, of the outer shell, now they will become loyal friends. They will accept you. That's kind of the idea.
That's great. I love that. I've never heard that.
Check it out. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, I'll have to do that. Okay, so here you, did you know that before you came to the United States, or did you
I experienced it, yeah.
Okay.
And it was really a shock, honestly, because as I said, I would sit at the airport, you have people sitting close to you, next to you, and they start to talk to you, which is kind of pleasant, but they will share stuff, you know, that I will never share on the first time I meet someone. You know,
right.
It's even to the point I will tell you, if you come to my neighborhood, you should come get a coffee. I'm like, wow, I'm sure that if I come, you may not even recognize me, you know.
Oh, that's a scream. Whereas with French, it takes a while to break down, but then you're included and you're nestled in. Exactly. Yeah, I've been to France and I can definitely see that.
Yeah, yeah. And even part of France, it's sometimes different. I mean, the north of France is said to be a little bit colder, a bit harder to break the shell compared to the south of France, where it's warmer. Same thing, they open up very quickly, etc. But it may take actually a little bit more time to get close to them.
Well, I do remember when I was over in France when I was in my early 20s and I was traveling with my parents, and I had taken French in high school and college, and I had gone all day with doing all the communication, and we get into a taxi to go back to the hotel, and I said, "Exhausted. Do you speak English?" Well, he starts laying into me, "You Americans, you come here, you expect to, you know, speak English." Yeah. And he was from Vietnam. He wasn't even from France. And I used my best French, and I just talked him up one side and down the other. And I said, "I've been speaking French all day, and I'm really tired." Like, I don't even know where the French came from.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, especially in Paris, obviously, you know, Paris is like New York a bit. They can be difficult, but they're difficult with everyone. So you should not be offended if you go to Paris and you think like people are rude. They are rude to everyone. Sorry for the Parisian, but that's the truth.
Yeah, but he wasn't even Parisian. I mean, that's what got me. He was from outside the country, and he was going to give. And everybody else I found delightful. I mean, I didn't have any of that nasty, rude Parisian French. I mean, you know, it was very cordial and nice and helpful. So,
that's great.
And I knew that. I know there's that reputation, and.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah. It can happen. It's better on the in the suburbs or in other cities, but Parisians are not. It's like New York, as I said. You know, they are pretty. They are busy. They are on their life, and they think that they're center of the world, and they're moving fast. And you're like, okay, especially when you're a tourist, you're like looking at stuff, and you know,
get out of my way. Are you gonna order? Beep beep.
Exactly. Yeah.
So city and country is definitely a different culture, mm-hmm. probably in every country. All right. Yeah. So here you are in the United States or Southeast. Let's do United States versus France to start with. Like, what? How do you figure out how to do business? Like, what were your experience in Southeast Asia? What did you have to figure out in the United States? And what could people here in the United States take and apply to other places they're doing business?
I think one of the main challenge, you can have a lot of reason to fail in the US, especially if you're coming from outside, right? I mean, coming into the US, you have to be really focused on what you want to do. A European company, the risk is that you're coming, you have your business in Europe or in Asia, you know how to sell, you have your customers that is already established, and you think that, okay, I got a great portfolio, so I'm going to go to the US, it will be easy. But that's a first mistake. You need to really have a clear focus on where you want to go. You cannot go 360. You need to really try to target where you're going to make a difference and what kind of difference you will be able to make versus your competitors. So understand the market and putting together market strategy, I guess, it's really key. And its goal is really to understand what is your value proposition. You know? So you have to be very careful to be able to be efficient. What I did when I started, it was first to see how I could replicate the successes we had in Europe and in Asia. So I remember asking marketing in France, who are our top customers? Are there anyone that have any branches in the US? And so I would go after customers that we know we were doing business with in Europe and Asia, but not in the US, and try to approach them using references we had in other countries, saying, okay, listen, we are doing business. You don't know us right now because we didn't have any brand recognition that was adding to the challenge. So I would tell them, okay, you don't know us, but this is what we have been doing with your companies overseas. We had some success. They are using us. They trust us. So how can we work together and duplicate the successes that we had in other countries? So that's one way. It was one way to break the ice. Because
that's
now,
a great idea because you're leveraging your global connections then.
Exactly. And they will see that being used by their counterpart in other countries, it means we were a quality manufacturer, quality supplier, right? So that was one way to get started. And then also I was trying to work on how can identify niche market where after I look at our competitors, where maybe I could make a difference. I could bring some value that our competitors were not maybe market where they were not addressing or were not targeting 100%. At that time, back in 2011, the solar market was just starting. And we had only one competitor that was providing a solution, and it was not the best solution. So we managed to work with the engineering team, with the marketing. I had great support from a corporate, and we were able to develop a solution that was more cost effective, had a better footprint, and that was a kind of a nice success for end users. So we managed to really skyrocket our business through that specific business with products that we identified the right time and we were able to develop quickly for a specific application.
Okay. So number one would be really kind of leverage relationships, your global relationships you have already to get into new markets. Number two would be to look at niche markets and the value that you can offer where competitors aren't.
That's right. That's right. And last but not least, but this is what we work in our case, was also to identify potential partners. As I mentioned, the fact of not having any brand recognition make it very difficult. When I was calling customers, sometimes I didn't know who we were, so I didn't know what we would be able to offer. So my strategy was to see, can I work with some of the big players in the US market to target those customers? And I managed to identify big players. I don't know if I can say the name here, but I managed to identify a few of them and approach them. And I managed to get them to use a product, but we put their name on it. So it was one way to use their Salesforce, use their distributor channel, you know, and to be able to have a direct visibility into the US market. So we call it a brand labeling. So we did a lot of brand labeling. It was a third way of having access to opening the market, basically.
Wow, that's a great idea. So it really is white labeling.
Mm-hmm,
so you're bringing in the product, but they're adding a
but we
sale
put their name on it. So it's our product, but we remove our name, or sometimes we just say it will be a customer, it will be X brand made by our company name, or sometimes it's just a private label. We just put their name on it, that's it. So, except if you know who is the initial manufacturer, the end user doesn't have any clue of who is doing it, and they think that a private label is a company who is actually doing it.
Right, right. And the advantage of that is then you don't have to set up operations. You don't have to hire the sales force.
Exactly.
You're accessing their distribution channel. So you're saving. You may cut the margin on what you're making on it, but you're saving all the expenses.
Exactly. And you have a lot of visibility. You have a lot of visibility because those guys already have a pre-established brand in the US. As you say, they have the sales team in place, they have distributors in place, they know where to push your product. So you're saving a lot of time. So it's coming at cost because obviously you are a little bit more aggressive on the price, but at the same time, it really helps you to gain momentum in the market. So it's called a private labeling or brand labeling. That's that would be the name for it. So all these help us, for example, on my territory, when I was in charge of sales and marketing, we started from zero and we reached $12 million in 4 years.
Wow, that's fantastic.
That's pretty good, yeah.
Yeah.
That was really exciting, yeah.
So you came up with some really creative strategies. You obviously had great success. You must have hit some problems along the way.
Well, some of the challenges were actually mainly with HQ, in the sense that obviously when you start a business like that in North America, for any startups, et cetera, I think that you need to understand that it's taking time, right? You cannot, what can be a little bit difficult for a company that is well established in a different country is that they think that they're going to come to the US and sell it right away and generate a return on investment very quickly. So challenge that when you have no presence, you have to build everything. And obviously you have competitors, so no one is waiting for you, right? So you have, it's taking time because you need to build a relationship, that people to trust you. And you also need to make sure that you have the right organization in place to support the customers. I think it's something that is very crucial is how you're going to provide the right customer service to your customer. And this is also part of the challenge that we face from time to time is that culturally, French people sometimes will say, oh yeah, we'll deliver this product in 2 weeks. So if you take this and now you're in the US and you go see your US customer and tell them, okay, in 2 weeks we get the product. They're expecting to get the product in 2 weeks, right? So, but in French, they may sometimes say, oh, we were late, so it will be 3 weeks. So the challenge that when you have to go back to your customer saying, oh, sorry, we're going to be late now, is that you start to, especially when it's the first time you're selling to those guys, they're like, okay, what's wrong with you? You know, you promised 2 weeks, now it's 3 weeks. So you need to be very straight forward and make sure that you are not doing these kind of mistakes because it leaves a bad taste in the mouth of your customer. And when you have one shot, it might actually burn you, right? So you need to be very careful. So that's the kind of challenges we had to face. We had to re-anticipate these kind of issues to the point that at one point we build up a stock locally to try to prevent this type of missteps.
So what do you recommend to somebody who's going into another country to figure out something like that?
Well, I think it's very important to obviously try to see what the competitors are doing, talk to the customers, understand also what they expect, what they are willing to accept as in terms of services that you're going to provide, what they feel comfortable with you doing or not doing. So by talking to a few customers, you try to gather a lot of information and you can try to have a general idea of what can be done and not done.
Yeah, so I think about, you know, a French person coming over here and they start doing their market research and they talk to the customers and clients and they're like, you know, is delivery 2 weeks okay? The customer says, sure, that'd be great. Yeah, it's probably okay if it's 3 or 4 weeks too, because in our production line, you know, we don't really need it. So the French person hears, we'll tell them 2 weeks and we'll get it there by four.
Yeah.
Whereas, if you don't understand the culture, if that person says 2 to 4 weeks, they don't want 2 to 4. They want either 2 or 3 or 4, so they know what to expect. So
exactly.
How do you,
right. Yeah.
So you've worked in very drastically different countries.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do that market research so you understand expectations behind the words?
So some of the things I've done, it's kind of, I would do a few tests, right? I would never try, I will start with a few small customers. Small customers, I mean in terms of potential, because I know that if I burn myself with the small customers, it's not the end of the world. So at the beginning, I would try to see how I can adapt the business with a few smaller accounts and see how things are working. And so I will learn from them, obviously. My goal is not to satisfy them, obviously, but I know that if something is not going right, at least I'm not putting in jeopardy a lot of lot of my business. And once I have a good understanding of how things are working with a small one, now I will be able to go to the bigger fish and say, okay, I know what didn't work out. I know what needs to be improved. So I know that when I talk to the big customer, there are a few things I cannot do because I'm putting myself at the risk of losing the business or of missing an opportunity to do business with them. You see what I mean?
Okay. So really, it's doing your homework, figuring out who your market is. You're having a market strategy, you have a value prop, and then you test it out on the small customers.
Yes.
So by the time you go to the big, you've got the feeling.
You know what you need to do.
Yeah.
What can be done. Exactly.
So talk to me about the value proposition. Mm-hmm. Did you find that was the same in your industry across different markets?
More or less. Actually, we had a few core products we were able to push the same way as it was in Europe. Actually, in some of our product offer, we the North American territory were some of the biggest one for the company. So that was pretty exciting. You know?
Yeah.
We were able to generate more volumes than ever in other country. So that was very satisfying, and it was very awesome to see.
Especially when they said, oh, can you sell in Chicago? And they drop you in and then you grow it to the biggest market.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, so for some product range, we were killing it. So we were able to be one of the top users. We were really putting a lot of pressure on manufacturing. That was pretty awesome to see. And there are others that didn't work so well for different reasons. I mean, we were not really... the market was much more mature than we expected. And so it didn't take off as much as we wanted to. I mean, competition was fierce. There were a lot of specifications that took place. And so we were kind of late in the game to do that and to catch up. So it was a little bit harder on that side. But
when you came into the United States, was the value prop... It's a French headquartered company, right?
France. That's right. Yeah.
It's in France headquartered.
It was, yeah.
Okay. So is the value prop in France the same that it was in Southeast Asia and the same in the United States?
So the main difference we faced actually was linked to the standard. We had some limitation because of the standard. In the US, we had to comply with the UL standard, obviously. Whereas in other parts of the world, customers were fine with the IEC standard, and most of them, 90% of them, were using IEC products. So that kind of put right away a differentiation in our catalog, because we had to develop solutions that were really customized for North America. Some of them were adapted from an IEC product, so it's really based out of the IEC European standard. So it was fine, but for most of our product, we had to comply to the US standard. So it's kind of a barrier, basically, because you had to go through certain testing and go through certain agencies to validate your product to be able to sell in North America. So right there, you already have to make some decision what product you're going to push. And if you want to push a specific product, you need to invest to make sure that's going to be compliant to the standard of North America.
Okay. And so the product had to be compliant. So you're mm-hmm. taking that in, and that's really on the engineer operation manufacturing side.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
But then on your marketing materials, there's a value proposition as to why somebody would want to buy your product. So say you have three products in the United States that all meet the standard US criteria.
Mm-hmm. So here to that point, it's really to understand who are the target for who is going to be, who is going to use it, what kind of product, and what is the unique value compared to competitors. And in France, sometimes they would sell with based on features. But the storytelling in the US is a little bit different, right? You are trying to really show your customer what is the value of your product and why it's different from your competitor. And that's it's something that we had to also do as far as all the marketing literature we put together. And it was one of the challenges we faced because we couldn't use all the time the material that HQ provided. We had to rework, readapt some of this material to make sure our message was going to be more in phase with our customers' expectation. And so the features was not really the main criteria for US customers. They didn't care about how big was a product sometimes or etc. Really, you really had to show them what value it's going to bring to them.
Okay, so in France, the marketing is still features-based, whereas in the U.S., we talk about benefits and then the value prop or the unique selling proposition.
That's right. That's
and
right.
So, it's different. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So were you even aware of those terms when you came into the U.S.?
Like, no, I find out basically, you know, when you would be talking to some customers and you see that they are not reacting the same way as they would in France or in Europe or in Asia, you start to wonder, okay, why did my message didn't work out? You know, I think that's very important to be able to always question yourself, right? When you see that, I mean, you had, and once again, we are back to the culture because what if I say at the beginning I was not based in the US, I was traveling back and forth until they decide to move me here in the US. So I would be in France trying to set up an appointment with a customer. And very kindly, they will accept to meet me because they know I would be coming from far away. They are curious to hear about what I have to say. And you have this meeting, everything's going well. You're like, oh, that's strange because, I mean, it was a nice discussion. I saw that the guy really engaged with me and you don't see any order, nothing happened. So when I was on site, when I finally moved into the US, it was easier to understand why. Because once again, you have to learn about, you want to create a relationship, obviously, when they don't expect to follow up in the next 3 months, or they don't expect to see you on a regular basis, they are kind of less keen to do business with you. And then it's you're thinking about, okay, is my message the right one? And you also try to see what the competitors are doing. You obviously, I was doing a lot of benchmarking, looking at what the main competitors were doing, how they would put the messaging out when they launch new products. And this is how we figured out, okay, we need to change our the way we are talking to our customers. We need to see, we need to change the priorities and how we are putting our product out there. So that's how we finally learn about it.
Okay. So let me get this straight. If you're in the US and you're going to France to schedule an appointment with somebody, they'll of course take it because you're coming from far away and they'll make time for you.
It's possible, yeah.
But they're not going to do business with you
immediately. Not always. Not always. Yeah. I mean, except if you have the greatest products that they've heard about that they want, obviously. But
it's not the cultural expectation. The cultural expectation was that you'd follow up and develop the relation, crack the coconut shell.
Exactly. So,
and then they'd be loyal to you and they'd buy with you if you make that.
Yes.
We're here in the U.S. You can't get an appointment with them. But if you do, there's a good chance you're going to sell them.
The odds are increasing, I guess. Yeah, it's not a gimme, but it's already a good start, right? But it doesn't mean you're gonna, because the problem is that they may accept to meet with you, but they wanna see if there is a real interest for them to meet with you and if they can use your product. But still, you need to convince them that your product is going to bring them value, the values that your competitors are not able to provide today.
Right. And so the features, benefits, conversation. So by the time you get to the selling point in the in France with people, you've already built that relationship and trust. So they just want to look for the specifications because they're choosing the person to do business with.
In
the US, they figure, you give me something that's going to benefit me, then I can trust you and we can go from there.
Yeah, and you need to have the right relationship because once again, you need to make sure you are able to engage with them on a regular basis, right? You cannot just see them once and come back 6 months later hoping that they're going to open the door again, right? That's why at one point in our business, we decided to put in place distributors and manufacturing reps because I mean, I had seven sales guys covering North America, Mexico, USA, and Canada. It's a big territory.
Yeah.
And I cannot expect them to see all the customers that there were on their territory. But now using reps, it's a good strategy because those reps are local, they're in different places all over the US, and they are used to visit those customers, they are golfing with them on a regular basis, they will go to a restaurant, have a beer, whatever, with all those guys, and that's creating a relationship. So they will trust the reps instead of the sales guys that is coming to visit them only once a month or once a quarter. So that's why this type of setup is quite useful in North America. And something that is not at all familiar in Europe, the notion of reps, when you talk about it, they're like, what are you talking about? Why should we pay agents to do the work? And so you have to explain to them, well, you know, the US is so big, you can feed friends in Texas, you know?
Right. So the key managers can be having those relationships because the territory is so much smaller.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's a bit easier. I mean, a sales guy in France, they can visit 10, 20 customers a day, maybe. I mean, try to do that in the US. It's impossible.
Oh, yeah. So that's a much different model. Okay. So here you are coming into the United States, that makes a lot more sense as to why companies are going to have to build out their sales force or their presence, their people presence a lot quicker.
You have to. And one way is you can have your direct salespeople, but you cannot hire, when you're a small structure, you cannot hire 150 sales guys to cover North America, to cover the US, right? So you need to start small, and start small by getting guys maybe on the West Coast. Obviously, when you have done your study, you know where the market is. So maybe the West Coast is a good area, the East Coast most likely, and probably in the Midwest to get started. You have three guys, okay? So that's one way of starting. You can concentrate once again on maybe key accounts, maybe on the niche market where you know that you're bringing value.
Can you hold the microphone up again? It's getting muffy. Yeah, there you go.
So
okay,
you can target key accounts, you can target maybe brand labeling accounts, or the niche market you try to address. And then the other way, the next level will be distributors and manufacturing reps. Because now, once you train them, you educate them, those are going to help you to hit the ground and basically increase your presence and your brand name on the field.
So those are good ideas for coming into the United States. Now, what advice would you give people or, you know, leaders who are trying to go outside of the United States? Because there's always a question of, you know, do I hire a sales force? Do I get a distributor? Do I have partners? And hiring is very different in a lot of other countries because mm-hmm. there's a lot more regulations and commitments that you make to the employees. So how would you recommend people going over to Europe or Asia build that presence on the ground?
I would say that it's
or
probably...
Or build sales. They don't have to, you know, do they have to build a presence or can they? How can they build sales?
I don't know if there is a general rule of thumb, to be honest. It's probably really on a case-by-case scenario. There is nothing that can beat a direct sales guy to get started because you have someone who is trained with your product to understand where the market is, and it's an easy way to get started. And once you have this person, it's probably easier to identify maybe after that distributors who can also serve you well. I would say it's probably a mix between a direct guy and a distributor, basically. I mean, I remember places like Singapore. In Singapore, we didn't have any direct guy. We had distributors, but those were really specific trained distributors. And I think it can be a good fit too, because if they don't sell, obviously, they don't make any revenue, right? So as long as you support them properly with the right tools, It's a good way to push your product if you don't want to invest in a sales guy. But there are places where you may need a presence, someone who is able to represent the company directly, and you would have no other choice than to have a direct sales guy to get started.
How would you recommend somebody entering a new market find a distributor?
Same thing. I would do probably some benchmarking and see who my competitors are using potentially, or try to find the distributors who have a line of products that can be complementary to the product I have. So you know that when the distributor is visiting a customer, they can talk about their product offer, but they can add now to add your product. It's pretty natural, and it's not a big stretch for them, right? Because the problem is to find people who are able, because you can appoint any kind of distributors, but if they're not talking about your products, right, it's useless. So that's kind of such a challenge, so to find people who are able to engage with your product because their core product is already quite aligned with the industry you want to push it.
Okay. That's good advice, because I hear oftentimes that there's problems with the distributor and company, but I guess that's it. If you find one that is pushing a complementary product, they're going to naturally be talking about you. So that builds, when there's enough money, there's less conflict.
That's right. Yeah. The challenge with distributors sometimes that they expect sometimes a manufacturer to provide sales lead and basically to transfer business, and they're acting like a mailbox. And that's not the kind of distributors you're looking for. You're also looking for people who are proactive, who are going to incentivize their sales team and motivate them to push for your product offer, right? That's a big difference. So sometimes it's relevant to use a smaller distributors because you know they are going to be hungry and go after the business. It happens in a few scenarios that it's a bigger name. You think that it's nice because they already have a nice coverage, but they're not pushing your product because now you are the features product range in their portfolio, and if they don't get a big commission out of your product line, they're not going to push it. So you may be in their catalog, but they're waiting for customers to order what they have based on the catalog, but they're not actively pushing for your product.
Right.
That's kind of the thing you need to measure, evaluate. And I mean, it's pretty easy to do when you put some contract in place. You want to ensure that you're going to support them by providing training, by doing joint calls with the distributor and the sales team. And you give them some targets, realistic targets, of course, but targets that will force them to push your product. And if they can't achieve them, and you try to support them and they still can't deliver, well, you find another distributor who is willing to do that.
Okay.
So it can take some time, but you will finally get the right one for your product offer.
So I've got to ask, because I'm really curious, we touched on it with culturally adapting the features and benefits. How did you handle your translations or multilingual communications?
It's funny you ask that. So we had a base that was it's one of the complaints I have, because some of the catalogs we'll be getting from HU sometimes were more UK English and American English. Just basic stuff like, you know, just think about the fact that you use a comma for the thousands in numbers, you know, you don't use a metric system. So just this was a reason for us to rework locally some of our literature. And what I would do is to use basically people in our marketing team. Some of them were obviously Americans, and our business development and our sales team to review the material and make sure that it would fit what we needed. So it was really a collaborative work. We had a frame. We had to frame basically the core of the marketing that was already provided by HQ, and we would rework it locally and adapt it based on our needs.
So HQ is in France. They create everything in French. Mm-hmm. Then it was sent off to a translation agency. Who did the translation?
Yeah, they had some people locally in France, or they would use our colleagues in UK. We had also an office in UK, so we had a Markham in UK and a marketing team. So those person would be in charge of adapting the tools for UK. So usually we mainly use what came from UK as a base, and we would get our American colleagues to rework it to make it more American instead of English UK.
Okay, and so if they wrote the marketing content for the French audience, they wrote it in mostly features language.
Yeah, it was right? Different. Yeah.
So when the translation was done, it still had the features.
Oh, definitely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So when you took that, then did you actually change the content or just
adapt? That's right. No, that's why we're working with our sales team, our business developer team, and the marketing team locally in the US to adapt it and to make the necessary changes that we had to. So okay. I had a team who was in charge of doing that, and they would work with our American colleagues to have something that would be acceptable for the North American team.
Okay, and do you think it would have worked for you if you got the original French and the UK and you sent it off to an agency that could handle that for you? Or did you really feel like it was better to have it done in-house with all these different people?
No, to be fair, it was just to be efficient cost-wise and because we had some resources. But naturally, it's something I tried to investigate. At one point, I was trying to approach an agency who would be able to help us out. But since it was kind of complex technically, I identified one that was used by our competitor, and I approached them. But unfortunately, they had some exclusivity with our competitor, so I was not able to use them, sadly. But I would be concerned using a translator that they had to have a good feel of the technical behind the technical translation, right? I think that was kind of the hurdle, is the fact that you have to have someone who can understand the technical challenges that we were facing and make sure that the translation was going to be appropriate. It's really a specific vocabulary, you know, so that make it a bit harder. It would have been feasible, but we still probably would have had to be engaged and double check some of the things. So just because it was easier to do it in-house, we did it in-house. But you're right. I mean, using someone to help us out in this task would have been helpful. But it's something you would have to build on the long term, because it's now you need to have someone who understand the product, the terminologies, the vocabulary, what we are trying to achieve. And I think this task itself is not easy.
No, it's not easy, but there are technologies that help with that, because you can develop a glossary. Mm-hmm. So if you have specific technical terms you're using all the time and there's specific words in the target language you want to use, you can build that glossary, and then there's consistency there. And then making sure you have the right person, and that person is continually working on it.
Yeah.
And then by the time your staff would get on it, then they're just giving it a cursory review rather than having
probably
to
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that is a challenge.
Yeah. But something I think you're right to your point, something worth it to consider. We were still in a size, we had 25 people, it was still manageable at our level. We would have grown more, I think it would have made sense to outsource it at one point, because it's a way of getting our team to focus on something more important.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I tried that. Yeah, it didn't. So one I found was unfortunately in a exclusivity agreement with our competitor. So that didn't work out.
Yeah, I'm just surprised they had an exclusivity contract, because you can put. It depends on how big the agency is, but you can put different people on
it. I think they told me that most of their business were coming from them, and they didn't want to have any risk of being kicked out of their contract.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. That makes sense.
Really concerned about that.
Yeah. So if you were talking to a business leader on somebody that was thinking about going global, what would be your top recommendations for them?
Being global.
What would be the first step?
I think it's really to make sure you have a good go-to-market strategy, right? That would be the first, probably the first advice. Understand, take the time to really work on your market strategy. Make sure that you take the time to visit a few customers to validate your strategy, because you can talk to customers and tell them, okay, this is what we try to achieve. Does it make sense? And you will get some feedback, and you can try to properly refine what you try to do. I think that would be a good way. Mm-hmm. And make sure that you understand what is your value proposition. How, as I said earlier, you cannot push all the products sometimes that you have, because you need to be able to identify what is going to work best. And once you do that, you know that when you're going to push this, you will be able to generate some success. And when you generate the success, it's like the ball that's rolling, you will be able to build around this success and add more products to your offer.
Yes.
So I will do that. And then it's really a matter of being able to find the customers. So the lead generation is also another topic, how to generate, obviously, the leads. It's a big challenge. But once you are able to do that, it's identify how to close a deal. And then it's going up and up, right? You're building on top of this. You have the momentum, and you know that when you grow the sales, you will be able to hire more people. Usually after, when we're able to generate $1 million, we know that we were able to get another sales guy. So now you try to identify, okay, where are the market where there will be some growth, where we can put a sales guy, and you keep building on this, and it's pretty exciting. It's a nice adventure. But it's a really, I think, something that's key when you try to get, once you've done all this, especially if in North American market, if you want to come here, you need to be patient. Some French companies, for example, I know I've seen some P&L, some plan participating in some accelerator project.
Yeah.
They work on their plans. They think they are going to make money in a year, and it's taking much more time than that. So first, they underestimate the cost. It's costing money to do business in North America, so you need to be ready to invest, and you invest for the long term. And then you need to be patient, because you cannot build something in 6 months, especially when you need to work on the market strategy, on the value proposition, etc. It's taking time. But when you've done your homework and you've done it well, the business is going to start and you will be successful.
So you just said something that I found was very interesting. You said when you hit $1 million, then hire your first sales rep. So mm-hmm. that was kind of the benchmark that you put in.
Yeah, usually, yeah.
And when do you hire your second one?
You can potentially every $1 million, you can justify to have a sales guy.
So it's almost every million of your company.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. I'd never heard that kind of.
This is what we did.
That's what you did.
Yeah.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah, because you can pay for your the salary, etc., and all the costs associated with it. And you can start to make money. So it makes sense.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, that's a good business metric to think mm-hmm. about it that way. Yeah.
That worked well for us.
Yeah. 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 On your industry, of course, it would have to be industry particular.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, if you are making a lot of profit, maybe it would be less than that. But with our industry, that was a good threshold. $1 million was good enough for us to justify to hire a sales guy.
So you said if you're making a lot of profit, so was there a formula between net income and total profit to
You can, yeah, you industry. Can probably, yeah, you. If, I don't know if there is something, maybe it would make sense, but I know that in our business, with the profit we're making and the cost of the sales guy, that was a good indication.
And then did you have salary and commission or just salary?
It's a salary and a bonus, all plus all the other costs associated, you know.
The entertainment costs and the travel costs.
Yeah,
that all adds in. All right, so let's switch it over to a personal side again. Okay, you ready for some fast questions?
Tell me.
Favorite vacation?
Favorite vacation? Right now it has been Peru.
Peru. Yeah. Oh, wonderful. Machu Picchu? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It was awesome. Best food I had ever. So
that's far. Oh yes, that was. We went awesome. To. I took my boys to Peru and we did a trip through the Amazon and Machu Picchu. It was. I think that was one of my top ones too.
Yeah, the food was amazing.
What's your favorite memory of a cross-cultural experience that might have been very unique? Maybe, and let's put it in business.
Well, I have one. I have one in Asia. It's when I had to try a food that I didn't want to know what it was.
And did you try it?
Yeah, I tried it, but I could tell you, I closed my eyes and I just swallowed it right away.
And did you, what was it?
Oh, I had a different, so many weird stuff. I mean, going from swallow nest, to abalone, some weird sea snail. Sometimes ugly stuff I ate because it was of matter. I mean, the customers I was with, I were important customers, and for them that was a treat.
Oh, so you closed your eyes, you swallowed it, and then
you didn't want them to lose face because they were really happy to invite me to this fancy restaurant with fancy food, but that was not easy.
Oh, how funny. Now, would you have to do that in the United States, or could you decline
No, it was fine. No, I think I would be okay to say, no, sorry, I don't want to try that. Especially now, I'm a vegetarian, so I won't do that anymore.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That is but funny.
At that time, yeah, that was, oh, my God. I mean, like, I would tell you, in Vietnam, I drank a blood snake.
Really?
Yeah, blood snake mixed with rice alcohol. And I ate snake like cooked in 10 different ways, from grilled to boiled to even the snake skin were cooked as chips. That was kind of, but the snake blood, it came. So when we got into that restaurant, I had to pick up a snake. There were cages of snakes. I picked the unlucky one. And like 10 minutes later, I was sitting at the table with my customers and the waiter came with four glasses and I didn't realize it was blood mixed with rice alcohol. And there was the heart still pumping on a small plate. And they asked me if I wanted the heart. I said, no, I will pass on that one. But I drank the blood and it went straight away.
Did you taste it?
No. I mean, it tastes like blood, but...
It did taste like blood.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That was a tough one.
Yeah. Have you ever had sea urchin?
Yes, that was fine. That's okay.
Yeah, I've never had that. I keep meaning to order it, but nobody I go out with ever wants to share it with me.
Yeah, no, so. That was good. This one was okay. That's not the worst, yeah.
Okay. All right.
But that's kind of the thing. I mean, you discover, you know, what I would do now on the other hand is when I had Asian people coming to France sometimes, the one who are a little bit tough on me, I would get them to try some smelly cheese.
Smelly cheese, yes.
Because smelly cheese is it's worse for them. So I feel like it's like, that's something.
That's right.
If you're not used to it, it's like, oh my God, what is that, you know?
Yeah, so they're not used to the dairy cheese from Asia. And then you add in the smelly cheese. That's true.
That's can well, be, years can ago. Make it hard.
I was talking to a woman that came over from France to do business here. And I said, yeah, you go over to France and you have all these nice, fine foods that we think of as very French and very high end. I go, what do you eat in the United States that's very typical? She goes, oh, I'd take them through a drive-through McDonald's. Oh, that's horrible. That's what we're known for.
Yeah. That's funny.
All right. Favorite place to do business?
Favorite place to do business? California.
Okay. Craziest travel story?
Craziest travel story. Well, you know, when you travel a lot, you can have good and bad memories, right? I mean, I had a few planes cancel on me. I had to drive 4 or 5 hours instead because I couldn't wait for the flight. Sometimes I had a good memory when I got upgraded in first class on an international flight. That was pretty fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is nice. That is nice.
It happens sometimes. It's pretty rare, but
well,
when it
right
happens,
now,
like, yeah.
Right now, you can fly first class for about $150.
Yeah, I won't do that.
No. All right.
I'm happy not to travel right now.
Yeah. Yes. Where can people find you?
Well, right now I'm in Boston, the Boston area, right? I can be reached out on LinkedIn or can give me a call. I'd be happy to help or join me by email. But Boston is home, and I'm looking for my next challenge in the Boston area.
Okay. So if you want to find him on LinkedIn, it's Armand Adande. It's A-R-M-A-N-D. And then Adande is his last name, A-D-A-N-D-E.
That's right.
Search that, and you can put the French American Chamber of Commerce in there, and I'm sure you'll come up.
Yeah.
Or Boston. And then your email, why don't you go ahead and tell us that?
It's A like Apple, P like Paul, dot Adande, the last name, at gmail.com.
And you're looking for your next move to...
Yeah, next move. Now I'm currently looking for my next challenge. I'm looking for a leadership position in sales or business development, in manufacturing, energy, or electronics in the Boston area because I really love New England.
Wonderful. Okay. Well, hopefully the right connection is listening and they'll reach out to you here. Well, thank you for being on the show. It was really a pleasure speaking to you. I learned a lot.
Thank you, Wendy. It was a pleasure to be with you. I really appreciate the opportunity. It was very exciting. So thanks a lot.
Thank you. Well, merci beaucoup to everybody who was listening today. If you learned something or you had at least a laugh, tell somebody about this podcast if they're interested in global marketing. And you can find us on any of your favorite places to listen. We'll see you next time.
Thank you, Wendy. Take care, everyone.
That's a wrap for this session. A big thanks to you for listening to the Global Marketing Show. Hope you had just as much fun as I did. New sessions launch weekly on all places you find podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Google Play, YouTube, and of course on our website. If you know someone interested in this topic, please tell them about us. Au revoir for now.